I'll keep practicing. So, and just to also maybe encourage you to keep thinking about scattering amplitudes, let me start by summarizing a little bit some of the things we did this week. So, I hope you had the chance to appreciate that one of the reasons many people are thinking about these problems in n equals 4 super young meals is that there seem to be a fair amount of magic going on. Okay? So, starting at tree level, we saw many times these are invariants. So in Jake's lecture, we use Mathematica to discover many incredible identities that these R-invariants can satisfy. For NMHB, the R-invariants were single R-invariants, so we found that crazy sums of R-invariants agree with some other crazy sums of R-invariants. The identities became even more surprising when we went to N-squared MHB, where we had products of R-invariants with all these caps put all over the place. And we had 40 terms identities. And where is all that magic coming from? Okay? At loop level, there is also a lot of magic going on there. At loop level, it turns out that in n equals 4 super gem meals, as we saw, generalized unitarity basically fixes the amplitudes. Say, the simplest example would be one loop amplitudes. Just using generalized unitarity, you can completely determine what the amplitudes look like. This is quite surprising, and it's not true in other theories. Okay? At least, using generalized unitarity strictly in four dimensions is not true in other theories. Equally surprising, but more recent, is the fact that these objects in n equals 4 super young meals at loop level seem to have a very spectacular, simple structure in terms of the kind of functions that can appear, in terms of the algebraic, in terms of the analytic structure. And that was explored by studying the symbols. Okay? So, like the computation of the two-loop remainder function. Let me remind you that that computation, when done explicitly and just by brute force, or just by sitting and doing responsibly your job, ends up being pages and pages of conjure of polylogs, and all of a sudden this thing collapses into three lines just by using the symbol technology. It tells you that such a thing had to happen. So where are all these things coming from? Where is all this magic coming from? That's the question that is driving many of us to continue thinking about n equals 4 super young meals and scattering amplitudes there. Okay? So let me start by trying to give you some hints of what we think, or some of us think, might be directions that will lead us to answering the question of where all this magic is coming from. So let's start with the R invariants. Okay? Let me remind you what it was. Of course, you all have this implemented in Mathematica, so I shouldn't really be doing this. But we're going to do it in a slightly different way very soon. So it's convenient to start with this formula. Okay? Now, in terms of this, the six-particle amplitude, say, NMHB, would be written as the MHB amplitude times the sum of three R invariants, say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, plus 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, plus 1, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay? That's a six-particle amplitude that in terms of Feynman diagrams would take perhaps 200 Feynman diagrams, be extremely complicated to compute, but that's the answer. Okay? Now, already, there is something spectacular about this form, just this piece of the amplitude, which is that everything is given in terms of four brackets. And this implies that this piece has a symmetry, which is a conformal invariant symmetry. Okay? But it's not the conformal invariance that n equals 4 super Young Mills is famous for. So, even though it's not the usual one, we should give a different name, and we have been calling this dual conformal invariant. Okay? Now, just loosely speaking, let's just say that this is an SL4 symmetry acting on our twisters, or our momentum twisters. But we know that we have n equals 4 supersymmetry. So could this thing actually be dual superconformal invariant? The answer is yes. These objects are actually invariant under the supergroup. How can we make that manifest? Certainly, written in this form, it's not clear that if we perform a transformation that mixes bosons and fermions, we're going to get the same object. Okay? So my goal now is to write it in such a way where this symmetry will be completely manifest. So in order to do that, perhaps when you were implemented this in Mathematica, one natural thing would have been to say, well, maybe these coefficients are too long. This thing has the following structure, after all. Something like this. TE, maybe I can introduce some variables that multiply each of the eras . Okay, then the denominator will be extremely simple. It will just be TA, TB, TC, TD, and TE. And then I would do, well, I'll evaluate this where TA is the corresponding bracket, TB is the corresponding bracket, and so on. Okay? That would have been a way that we could have implemented this in Mathematica. Instead, we're going to use this as inspiration and say, well, look at this. This is interesting. Perhaps we can make something that is SL4/4 invariant if we could promote these objects in the denominator, and we could think about these constraints as something that we can impose with another delta function in such a way that this delta function will not be 0/4, but 4/4. Remember, if we find any function of the full supersymmetric momentum twister, ZA eta A, then we will have something that is SL4/4 invariant. Okay? So how can we do that? Well, what we're looking for is something that looks like this. 4/4 TA ZA plus TB ZB up to TE ZE. Okay? That would be super conformal invariant. Of course, it's a delta function, 4/4. So we have to be invariant under SL4/4. Okay? Well, now what do we have to do? Well, we have somehow these T's in the denominator, so we have to keep them there. And now we have four bosonic delta functions. We have four bosonic delta functions, and we don't want to impose constraints on the external data, so they will have to impose constraints on our internal variables, TAs, so we better integrate over them. Okay? Now you should immediately complain and say that this formula doesn't make any sense. Does anybody know why it doesn't make any sense? Well, it doesn't make any sense because if you see, I can rescale all the TAs by the same number, and this formula will not change. That means that there is a redundancy here. Which is a GL1 worth redundancy. So I have to do like in gauge theory. Since we are physicists, I can get away by saying I'm going to divide by the volume of GL1 in order to make this integral well defined. Okay? Now, note what I did, right? This should sound a little bit familiar. When we have Feynman diagrams and we want to make locality and unitarity manifest, what do we have to introduce? We also have to introduce a redundancy. The redundancy is gauge redundancy. Okay? So if you want to have locality manifest in a theory that contains massless spin one particles, you have to introduce a gauge redundancy. Now note what we have done here. If we want to have something, a formula that is SL4/4 manifest, invariant, manifestly invariant under that, we have to introduce this GL1 gauge symmetry. Okay? So this is our formula for the R invariant. Or at least that's what I claim. Okay? So how do we prove it? Well, as with any gauge symmetry, before we do anything, yes. Yeah, but I have a GL1 gauge symmetry. Excellent question. I have a GL1 gauge symmetry, and I can use my gauge symmetry, right? Like with any gauge theory, you're not supposed to play with the path integral unless you do what first? Unless you gauge fix, right? So let's use a gauge fix. Gauge fixing, where, say, TA is equal to 1. Note that this redundancy tells us something interesting about this. If we think about TA, TB, up to TE as a vector in C5, what we're saying is that these different vectors, not all different vectors in C5 give me something interesting here. They are vectors that differ by a rescaling, give me the same integrand for this function, okay? So can anyone tell me what happens when you have a C5 and you don't care about the rescaling? What's the name of that space? So these points are really living in, this means that these points are really living in CP4. So the R invariant I claim is an integral over CP4. And I'm about to prove to you that this is indeed equal to what we got there. So let's use a gauge fixing where TA is equal to 1, okay? If we do that, now our integral becomes an integral over only 4 variables. As an exercise, show that the phi F Popov Jacobian of our gauge fixing is actually 1, okay? So I'm not paying any price for the phi F Popov Jacobian for gauge fixing this to 1. And I have 0/4 TA eta A up to TE. Sorry, TA has been gauge fixed to 1, TE eta E. And I have the 4 bosonic delta functions that tells us that ZA plus TB ZB up to TE ZE has to vanish. Now I can use the 4 bosonic delta functions to solve for all the T's. So let me do it here. So if we solve, say we can solve for TB, how can we solve for TB using that equation? Using the fact that this has to vanish. Well, we can get rid of all the other T's except TB by contracting, by using the contraction with. We want to contract that equation with C, D, and E. And we want to put that equation in here. And what do we get? We get A plus TB C, D, E, B equal to 0. And from here, we get that TB is equal to minus C. Let me actually write it as, well, doesn't matter, over C, D, EV. Okay? Now you can do it for the other ones, okay? Now the delta functions completely fix the integration variables, so we're gonna get from the TAs, from 1 over the T's, TB up to TE, we're going to get 4 different brackets in the denominator, 4 of the 5 that I need. Which one am I missing? Well, I'm going to be missing precisely C, D, E, B, which will appear in the numerator to the 4th power. That's a little bit annoying. So I'm a little bit far from what I want there. But note the following. First of all, I pay a Jacobian when I solve for these delta functions, okay? And the Jacobian that I pay is precisely one power of these guys, of this guy in the denominator. Okay? But now my fermionic delta function is not in the form that I want. So what is it? It's A plus brackets over brackets, eta B, and so on, because these are the T's. The T's became this. So in order to transform this in what I want, I have to pull out this factor from every one of the T's. So when I pull it out, remember, this is a fermionic delta function, so anything that I pull out of a fermionic delta function stays as it is. Right? So this thing is nothing but 1 over CDEB to the 4th delta 0/4, what I want. Okay? This cancels this, and I get my R invariant. So this is very good. So we now have a nice way of writing the R invariant that exhibits explicitly the dual superconformal invariants. Now we can use the trick that Jake taught us during the lecture. Actually, I was wondering, how is he going to extract all the eta components out of this in real time? And then he used a very, very clever trick. He said, well, all these guys are different R invariants. Sure, they are. But maybe we can think about the fermionic delta functions in the numerator, all of them as being the same object, except that sometimes some of the T's happen to be zero. Okay? So the trick that Jake taught us in his lecture was the following. Let's apply the trick to our formula over there. He basically told us that if we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe we should really be thinking about this as delta 4/4, T1, Z1, plus T2, Z2, T5, Z5. This is what I wrote there. But the trick that he taught us is that maybe we should just make it universal and have a T6 here. Okay? If you have that T6 there, what you have to do is to impose a condition where T6 is equal to 0 in order to get the corresponding R invariant, right? So what do? We integrate over the whole thing. We still have a volume of GL1 that we have to worry about. T1, DT2, DT6 over T1, T2, up to T6. And now we want to think about T6 as a complex variable, and we want to impose that this is a contour integral done around the contour where T6 vanishes, a little circle in the T6 plane where T6 vanishes, okay, around the origin. That will be a contour integral that will pick out the component or will pick out the R invariant that I want. You see that this is very interesting because now our amplitude is nothing but I can say that the amplitude, our four amplitude there, which sometimes we call P6 NMHB, okay, just to refer to this part. Is this integral done on this contour, okay? And this integral done on this contour plus this integral done on this contour. Okay? So by this, I'm representing what you get by performing this integral, the residue of this integral on this contour, and then adding up what you get by performing this integral on this contour, and so on. So a better way of thinking about this is the following. If you think about this integral without specifying a contour at the moment, it's an integral over a single complex variable, because after using the GL1, we can gauge fix one of the T's to be 1. There will be five remaining T's, and we have 4 bosonic delta functions. Therefore, this is really a function of a 1 complex parameter. Okay? If we think in that way, let's call that complex parameter z. Of course, anytime you have a complex parameter, if it's a single one, you call it z. And this function will have 6 poles in the complex plane. The t's become functions of z, linear functions of z. So there are simple poles, 6 of them. This is where t1 vanishes. This is where t2 vanishes, t3, t4, t5, and t6. Now, I can just tell you that the 6 particle amplitude is nothing but this integral performed on this contour. Okay? But you would say, well, that sounds silly. If I have a contour, nobody forces me to integrate collapsing this in this direction and picking up these 3 poles. I could have chosen to integrate and deform the contour in the opposite direction and pick out the other 3 poles. But guess what the other 3 poles are? The other 3 poles are precisely the other 3 R invariants that enter in the second way of writing the 6 particle amplitude. This is something that we tested in Mathematica with Jake, that the 6 particle amplitude could be written as the sum of these 3 R invariants, but it could also be written as the sum of 3 other objects that were completely different. So I hope you all tried that, because it's amusing to see how these two objects happen to be the same. But now you see the reason. There is no computation to be done. Of course, you use Mathematica to find the fact, and then you try to find the reason behind it. And you find that it's just a contour deformation. I could make one more remark here, which is that Jake also mentioned that in the R invariants there are physical poles and spurious poles. Spurious poles are crazy things that don't look like anything you would ever get from a Lagrangian, making the hope of getting from a Lagrangian a formula that has R invariants completely hopeless. Okay? Now, it turns out that the class of spurious poles that you get from these 3 terms, none of them agree with the spurious poles you get from these 3 terms. So these unphysical poles are not there in the amplitude. In fact, they can tell you, if you only knew the residues, what is the contour that you have to choose in order to get something physical that only has physical poles. Very good. Now, you would say, maybe this is just luck. This looks like something very nice for LMHP amplitudes. In fact, you can now continue and go to 7 particles where you can write it as an integral again. Okay? So let's go to 7 particles. Now we have DT7. That's all we have to do to go to 7 particles. Sorry? Thank you. But now, after all the dust settles, you use all the bosonic delta functions and everything, this becomes an integral over 2 complex variables. So this is really an integral over 2 complex variables. We can call dz1 and dz2. And each of the t's in the denominator becomes a function of 2 complex variables. Well, again, you can show that the amplitude, which Jake showed you, was the sum of 6 terms, okay? And indeed, there were many, many different ways of writing it as a sum of 6 terms. Those 6 terms are residues of this function, and the relations that they satisfy are residue theorems. So these are generalizations to many complex dimensions of our very well-known residue theorem, which in higher dimensions is called the global residue theorem. Okay? So I encourage you, if you haven't seen the global residue theorem, to go and find out what it is. Okay? But there is a more important question. The question is, did we just get lucky with NMHB? Is there a way to study N-square MHB? or to make any square MHD amplitudes manifestly dual superconformal invariant. So the question is, how about N square MHV? Remember, there we had the product of two R invariants, and one of them had a cap. It was, we could do it in Mathematica, but it doesn't really look like something that would look simpler, or that we have any chance of writing it as an integral. Okay? So I'll tell you the trick, which is probably not very motivated at this point, but the trick is to think about CP4 as a different space. Okay? So we said that this integral, say, in this case, was an integral over CP4. For seven particles, it's an integral over CP5. So if we have Pn NMHV, this would be an integral over Cp n minus 2. Now, I don't want to think about CP5 as CP5. I want to think about this as the space of lines in C5. Well, you would say that's what mathematicians tell you is CP5, right, in that case. Or in this case, sorry, CP4 in that case, CP5, I want to think about this as a space of lines in C6, okay? So in general, well, let me actually do it here. I want to think about this as the space of lines passing through the origin in C6, okay? That has a name in math. It's called the Grassmannian of one planes in C6. Okay? That's a fancy name for a projective space. But the good thing about this fancy name is that it depends on two variables, just like our amplitudes. Our amplitudes depend on n and k. But projective spaces only depend on one number, which is the dimension of the projective space. Well, these Grassmannians depend on two numbers. Well, then, sorry. So what happened here? Sorry, the space of lines in C7, right? These seven guys will make a vector in C7, okay? Sorry, so mess it up. Are there any questions? Because if you didn't notice my mistake, probably I'm losing you now. Sorry? Yeah, that's right. This is CP6. Very good, very good. Once you find one, then you will find many. Excellent. Okay. Very good. Now we're understanding. Yeah. Now, from this point of view, we can identify what the two variables mean. That's how I knew I made a mistake. Because we have two variables. We have n and k. In this example, this is 7 and 1, right? Well, why not identify this with that, right? So let's say this is an ansatz, and we can check what's happened, that somehow an amplitude with some n and k should be related to some Grassmannian with k and n. So what is this Grassmannian? It's a space of k planes in n dimensions. So how about n squared MHV? So we should have integrals over g to n. the space of two planes in CN. Okay. Why is this K, why does this K have anything to do with the K that we have here? Well, let me tell you why. So let's do it here. Imagine that we have something like this. Okay. This supersymmetric object only has four, it has degree, Grassmann degree 4, right? Which was appropriate for NMHB. But for N square MHB, we need something with Grassmann degree 8. So why not have another one? Say T prime. Okay. Now, if we put these two vectors together, say T1, T2, Tn, and T1 prime, T2 prime, up to Tn prime, you will see that these two delta functions together, they have a GL2 invariance that happens to be there. So if we have an element of GL2, we can apply it here and change the t's, and this thing will be invariant. And therefore, if we think about the t's as being vectors in CN, we now have two vectors in CN expanding a two-plane, but we don't care about which two vectors in that plane because we can perform a change of basis. So that means that the only physical relevant object is really the plane, a two-plane living in CN. Okay? So if this is, after all, a 2-by-N matrix, why don't we call it by what it is, a 2-by-N matrix? So people like to use N for this. D2N, D21, D22, and so on, D2N. And we can write this in a more compact form because now we can put the D's here with an index, say an index alpha, to represent that we have the rows, two rows. We get rid of this, and we multiply over the two values of alpha. Okay? And just as before, we have to integrate over all the variables, of which there are 2n. But once again, now this formula is starting to look like manifestly super conformal invariant, dual super conformal invariant. But in order to make that manifest, I need this gauge redundancy, which is this GL2 redundancy. Okay? Well, this measure is invariant under SL2. It's not invariant under a rescaling of all the matrix elements. If I rescale all the matrix elements, I pick up a Jacobian, and I'm in trouble because it's not going to be invariant under GL2. This thing is invariant under GL2 because it has a 4/4, so the overall factor is eaten up. So I have to compensate here with something that will make up or will eat up that Jacobian under a rescaling. Before, we had the elements of the matrix doing that job, right? So we had dTa over Ta. If we rescale all the t's by a factor, rho, this will eat up the transformation of the measure. Now we need something similar here, okay? But we cannot just write crazy combinations of the entries, say 3, 2, 3, and so on. Why not? Because these crazy combinations will not even be SL2 invariant. What are the only SL2 invariants that I can make out of this matrix? Well, the 2x2 minors of this matrix. Okay? So let me denote by ij the 2x2 minor made out of the ith column and the jth column. Okay? And I want to take the determinant of this. Okay. Now, this thing rescales as T square, say, or as rho square. If I rescale everybody by rho, this thing picks up a factor, which is rho square. The measure picks up at rho to the 2n, and therefore, I'll succeed if I put in the denominator n factors, n minors here. But how many minors do I have? How many distinct minors do I have? Well, there are n choose 2 minors, right? So I only need n of them. So which ones am I going to put here? Well, here is where color ordering enters, right? Remember, these are color order amplitudes. So there is a distinguished set of minors that I have to put, or that I can put, which is 1, 2, 2, 3, all the way to n, 1. So there are n minors that I can put there. Now, this is GL2 invariant, and I have to be careful to put the 1 over volume of GL2 here, and I'm going to call this LN2. Okay? Now you have your conjecture, your ansatz. Now what you have to do is to sit down and compute residues of this, and indeed you sit down and put Mathematica to work. If you are very clever, you can just ask Mathematica to scan over all the residues of this function, make a list. You make your list of all the residues of this function, and you compare them to the objects that appear in the n square MHP amplitude. And you find that every one of them happens to be one of the residues of this object. Okay? The surprise is that there are other residues that don't appear in the three-level amplitude. So could it be that this guy knows about something else? Not only three-level, but loops. It turns out that that's the case. We now believe that this object knows about the theory at all loops or at all loop order for a certain class of observables. Okay? Very good. So let me see how much time I have. Right. Now, what was the symmetry here? We had this symmetry, this SL4/4. Which I can write the generators as follows. Okay? Now it's obvious that this operator, if I apply it to this anything in this object, we are going to get zero. Right? But this was this dual. Superconformal symmetry. How about the regular superconformal symmetry? N equals 4 is famous for that. So what is it? Well, the answer to that question has to do with the following. Remember, we wrote the amplitude, say, the n particle amplitude, we wrote it as, or we separated it in two different ways. We also said that this was something like this, where these guys are dual superconformal invariant. But they are not superconformal invariant. The reason is that we know that the amplitude is the one that is superconformal invariant, and here we're factoring out a piece. So these are the ones that are superconformal invariant under the regular superconformal group of n equals 4 super young Mills. Well, if these guys are like that, and this thing seems to be a natural way of writing superconformal invariants, after all, the regular superconformal invariance is also an SL4/4. So why not try and write these guys as integrals of this form as well? Okay? Remember, in this case, we have the numbers that characterize an amplitude are n and m, and here the numbers are n and k. So we could give it a shot and try to write the a n, m amplitude as an integral over a Grassmannian, GMN, right? We can try our luck again. It worked one time. Maybe it will work a second time. The catch is that here, there is something funny. Remember, these amplitudes will be functions, the kinematic invariants or the kinematic data is lambdas, lambda tildes, and these eta tildes. Right? And the conformal group, the superconformal group, doesn't act nicely on these guys. It's kind of a mess. Like the translations are, it's a product operator. It's the operator lambda, lambda tilde. The generator of the generator of special conformal transformations is a second order derivative operator. So it's a mess. So we need to find a space where the superconformal invariance actually acts nicely as SL4/4 linearly on the space. It turns out that there is such a space. It's called twister space. And we can get there by Fourier transforming this object with respect to lambda. Okay? So I don't have much time to do that, but here is a claim. If you Fourier transform each one of these objects, say this one, and you Fourier transform with respect to all the lambdas, and you call the conjugate variables mu a, okay? And the resulting object, a tilde, that depends now on mu, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. The claim is that the superconformal group acts nicely on this object. There are several conventions in the literature, but I'll just follow the one I like because I'm the one giving the talk. So I'm going to call this combination WA for the eighth particle. And the supersymmetric version, when I put the eta tilde A, I'm going to call it curly A, curly W. Okay? Now, the claim is that all these guys in this new space are all given by exactly this formula, replacing the Z's by W's, okay? And the K's by M. That's it. So we succeeded in finding two representations, one that makes manifest superconformal invariance, and the other one that makes manifest dual superconformal invariance. Now you can ask, well, we have these two symmetries. Isn't that weird? Could they make something bigger if we act them together? But they seem to be acting on different objects, right? Remember, one acts on the P's and the other one acts on the A's. But now you can say, well, who cares? Let's try to pass one and force it through the A and make it act on the P's, say the superconformal invariance that acts on the nice A's. We can make it pass through the three-level MHV amplitude and make it act on the P's. Well, if you do that, you might expect that you will find a mess. But it's not that terrible. So the second one, which acts nicely on the W's, once you pass it through and make it act on the Z's, on this piece, you will find that it looks like this. So let's put something here, prime. And it looks like this, Z, A, del Z, A, Z, B, del Z, B, A, Z, Z, B, here, minus A goes to B. Okay? That's what it is. Now, if I had been the one who had found this, I would have said, well, I don't know what it is. Right? But if you ask somebody who does integrability, then they would say, well, we know what this is. These are the level zero generators of an algebra, and these are the level one generators of an algebra that is called a Yang-Yang. Okay? And we can call this level zero, level one. And with commutators of these guys, you can produce an infinite number of generators. So it turns out that these objects, these Grassmannian formulas somehow are the solution to the following problem. What are all the invariants of the Yang-Yang of SL4/4? Okay? So without knowing it, we just solve a math problem, which is nice. Okay. Very good. So how much time do I have? It's like 10 more minutes.
10, 15.
Okay. Very good. So this looks like something that could explain some of the magic we have been seeing, right? In fact, you see that this dual superconformal invariance, or this yang-yang, is something that is going to be very obscure from the level of the Lagrangian, because some of the generators will act very non-locally. So it's going to be a non-local transformation at the level of the Lagrangian, and we don't have any hope of seeing it. But precisely because this object and the residues of this object don't care about locality is the reason why we can explicitly see both guys in a reasonable, simple way from the same formula. In fact, you can apply this generator to this object, make it act on the delta functions, translate the action on the Z's by actions on the D's, and then ask, well, can I pass this through this and get something that is a total derivative? And just by asking that question, you can show that the only measure that will do such a job is the measure that we have put there. Okay? So that's yet another way of deriving this formula. So we seem to have good control at tree level. And as I told you, some of the objects that appear here happen to be things that don't have a tree-level interpretation. So the natural question is what they are. What are they? In order to go and answer that question, we can go back to something that I said at the beginning of that I said in the lecture, in the first lecture, which is that the old loop amplitude for n equals 4 and 5 was somehow completely under control at first for no good reason. We didn't know why. But now we know the reason. The reason is that if you factor out the tree-level MHV amplitude, the remaining object, you might say, I know the answer. The remaining object is dual superconformal invariant, and that's why it's under control. No, that's not the answer. The answer is that the remaining object, let me call it P, to all loop, is not dual superconformal invariant, okay? But it has an anomaly. And it turns out that the anomaly is very easy to compute, to determine. In this case, using the duality with Wilson loops, people were able to compute what this anomaly was. And now this is just a differential equation, so you can just solve it. Okay? And that's how you have n equals 4 and n equals 5 under control. And the reason is that this anomaly tells you that this has to be like that. But of course, you can add to this any dual superconformal invariant object or any dual conformal invariant object, and this guy will annihilate it. But there are none for n equals 4 and n equals 5 number of particles. That's why this completely fixes n equals 4 and n equals 5. Right? But what could the source of this anomaly be? And how can we try to derive things like this? Well, one reason the anomaly can appear is the following. Let's just look at one loop. Let me write for you the one loop four particle amplitude. This turns out to be A3 four particle amplitudes times this nice integral. Let me use a convention, plus, L plus P1 plus P2 plus P3 squared. Okay? Well, this integral, as you now know from Johannes' lecture, is infrared divergent. So we have to put a regulator. We have to use dimensional regularization. You can use Melin-Barnes, the MV package to compute it, and you will find something. But what if you choose a different contour? You could. You say, well, what do you mean? I know what the contour is. It's an integral over R4 and it diverges. Well, but we can think about this as a complex integral in C4 and choose a different contour. Now, every time you choose a contour that is compact, the answer that you get is something that doesn't have divergences. Of course, it cannot possibly have divergences. The contour is compact and it's not getting into trouble anywhere. Because I can choose a contour to be, say, 4 circles that are far away from the places where the singularities lie in this object. So I don't get any singularities. And you can show that whenever you take a loop amplitude and you evaluate it on such a contour, you get something that is completely Yang-Yang invariant. Okay? So where could the anomaly be coming from? Yeah, it's from the choice of contour. Okay? Yeah, I don't have time to write this in a nice way, so I'll just list the facts, okay? So, or the claims of things that we know now. So we know that on any contour, any compact contour, any all loop amplitude, or any L loop amplitude, in n equals 4 superjump mills, gives Yang-Yang invariant. Okay? This means that clearly the anomaly should come from the choice of contour. And here is a question. Wouldn't it be great if we could write L loop as something that has the integrations over the L loop variables? So let me call them L1, 4, up to DL, L4. Okay? Of something here, of an integrand which, under any Yang-Yang generator, would transform as a total derivative. And why is that? Well, because if I were able to do that, then the first two things would follow. Okay? So we want that guy to transform under the Yang-Yang generators as a total derivative. So that would mean that on any contour, it vanishes. So it's a Yang-Yang invariant. But on our funny physical contour that we happen to live in, we will get an anomaly. And I'll end by telling you how to build such a thing, or the basis of how to build such a thing. And it's nothing but generalizing what Jake told you. And it turns out that there is an all loop BCFW recursion relation okay, and what you do is to say first realize that there is a rational function that you can compute which is called the integrand of the theory which exists if you have a planar theory. So there is an integrand that you can define which is a rational function whose singularities, here is the most important thing. You can even do this for gravity. There is a way of defining a rational function that is sitting there. But here is a catch. There is a way of building a rational function whose singularities have physical meaning. And therefore, you know where they are and how to build a function that satisfies those. Those requirements of having precisely those singularities with those so let me end by giving you something that looks pretty much like what Jake had at tree level, but now at all loops. So let me denote by, well, I'll just do it like this, in pictures. So you want to be able to build the integrand for an amplitude that has m particles, it has r charge index k, and it's an L-loop integral. Now, under this deformation, you make something that depends on this complex variable z, and you use a very complicated argument to show that this is equal to the object you want to compute, okay? You just use Cauchy's theorem to say that this thing evaluated at z equal to 0 on the pole at z equal to 0 is the object you want to compute, but now you can deform the contour and pick up all the singularities of your object. But the claim is that they all have physical meaning. So what's the physical meaning of this function once I deform z by this? Well, it has factorization channels given by unitarity. So I'll have, this is what Jay called the bridge. So I bridge, just in the way we did it at tree level, we bridge amplitudes with lower k and l, n right, k right, and l right, okay? And sum over the ranges, the allowed ranges of k left and l left, okay? So this was a recursion relation at tree level. But it so happens that there is an extra term at loop level, and it comes from the fact that you can also hit singularities where a single propagator is cut, and those are called forward limits. So there is another term, which is the forward limit. And I'll end by writing what it is so that you can implement it in Mathematica as an exercise for today, or while you are on the plane. So this forward limit term is something that looks like this, and you will have to forgive me because I don't have time to tell you exactly what this means, but we can discuss that later today if you want. But just to show you that it looks like something that Jake wrote in his lectures, where this MAV is just one of his famous intersections, and where these APs are going to play the role of the loop variable. And this A hat is that's a formula. So you can now go and implement it in Mathematica and have the answer for any loop, any k, in recursive form, okay? Now, the interesting fact is that all these structures are made out of this Grassmannian formula in ways that preserve this Jungian symmetry. Therefore, when you apply the generator, whatever you build will satisfy this property, okay? So what's next? Well, the challenge for somebody is to actually use this to determine the amplitudes by determining what the anomaly is, and then reducing the problem of computing the amplitude to the problem of solving some differential equation, and perhaps making the connections of solving that problem to the problem of symbols, and rederive all the simple formulas that people have found from a less magical origin, Because at the moment, I think we all believe that these things look like magic or black magic, depending on your taste. Okay? Thank you very much.
Surprisingly, we managed to be on time, so there is time for questions about this lecture right now.
So just a stupid question. Now, when you do dimensional regularization, shouldn't you also recompute three-level in D dimensions, in principle?
Yeah, so you see, these formulas are all for the integrand, okay? So once you have it in terms of the integrand, Then the question is, what happens when you have to integrate this over something that has divergences? And then you regulate it. Okay? The way you regulate it is by going slightly into the Coulomb branch. Okay? And what it means in practice is that every physical propagator will be displaced by a master. Okay? And then you use dim, and then you use
for massive regulator. And but if you do dimensional regularization, then it's more painful, I guess, right?
If you use dimensional regularization, then there might be subtleties. Yes, there might be some subtleties. Yeah.
So let's then continue again at, let's say, at 3, so that we have time to see the questions, because we did receive some emails this morning. So, and let's thank Freddy once more.